Good morning, Carolina. Welcome to White Life, Death, and the Law.
Me.
I almost said Wife, Death, and the Law. Ooh, that'd be it. That could be a sister show. Yeah, that our wives do.
It's because your wife's out of town.
Well, she is out of town.
So she's top of mind.
Oh, where is she?
She's in Utah.
Okay.
And that's why I still am rubbing the sleep out of my eyes, because I've got teenage girls, my daughter and her friends, like, partying it up and keeping me up till 1 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm.
Is your wife from Utah?
No, but it's kind of like the central point for all of her family.
Okay.
She's got a sister from California and a sister from New York, and she has a niece that is going on a mission.
Okay.
And I think there's some other things happening that she for sure told me, but I don't remember what's going on. Oh, a wedding. There's a wedding that's going on in Utah.
That's probably the main reason.
That is actually the main reason. Yes, a family friend is getting married in Utah.
Aw, why didn't you go?
Somebody's got to pay the mortgage.
Okay.
So it's an interesting story because about a month and a half ago when the summer started, she had outlined everything that we were going to do for the summer on this giant calendar, and she had color-coded it and put a lot of time into it and was pretty proud of it and wanted to show me. And so she unveiled this calendar of all the events that we had going on, and it showed that every single week one of us was going to be out of town. So the question was, which one of us was going to join the other on their trip that was already basically planned, so we could do this family vacation, because you got to squeeze a family vacation in there. And I looked at her and I said, no, I'm not going to do any more traveling. Like, just looking at that calendar is making my eye twitch right now. And that was not the best way to start the conversation.
Okay.
She really wanted to do a family vacation. And of course, my son, who is 12, he always picks up on the cues as to what the tension items are, and very innocently will continue to bring them up, like, why aren't we going on a family vacation? When are we all
going on one single family trip this summer?
No.
Wow.
We went on a lot with each of the kids individually and with each other, but no, none all together, which is quite frankly my preference. I don't like big groups, and I have a big family, and that technically qualifies as a big group. So I know I'm a bad dad, but that.
Okay. I would assume you would run away from Yuma during the summer.
No, you know what? I like working on yard work. I like working. I've got this little dinky farm that I like to work at. And yeah, the heat, I'll grumble about it, but it's. For me to be stuck in the car or stuck in a hotel with a group of people is torment. And I'll brave 120 degree heat, you know, digging ditches for sprinkler lines in the desert anytime over that.
Okay. That's interesting.
But let's you're the guest here. I want to talk about where you grew up.
Okay.
Hermosillo.
Mm-hmm.
Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Hermosillo, yes.
Hermosillo.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about your background a little bit and how it shaped where you are today.
Well, I grew up in Hermosillo. I was born and raised there. And I lived there until I was 18. Then I moved away for college.
So when you grew up, at what point did you start learning English?
Ever since you're in kindergarten, they're teaching you English. Like, I probably
formally teaching you, but like informally, that's when you really get the hang of it, right?
Yes.
So when did you start really speaking English?
Honestly, I guess when I moved here.
Okay. When was that?
I was 23, I think.
So when you were 23, if we were to have this conversation, would you have a thick accent, but a good control of the language?
Yes. Even right now, I feel like I'm still insecure about my English.
Really?
Very insecure.
Oh, okay.
For example, I spent the last 2 weeks not speaking like a single word in English because I was on vacation. And I'm like, no, how am I going to record the podcast if my English is not well right now? That's how I felt.
Yeah.
But yes, even though I moved here when I was 23, I used to come to the U.S. probably like once every couple of months. So I would practice But once I moved here, it got so much better.
It's interesting because there's a lot of people today that, you know, are either social influencers or politicians that they're trying to work in some type of Latin slang or the accent, Latino accent, because it connects them with the people.
Okay.
You get to do that automatically.
I do.
And you might not recognize that that's actually maybe a benefit that helps you help your clients relax a little bit and know that you understand the broader view, you understand the cultural background of both being here and the opportunities in the United States and what's going on in other cultures as well.
Definitely. A big percentage of my clients only speak Spanish.
Really?
And to them is so important that my first language was Spanish and that I lived in Mexico most of my life.
Yeah.
So they know I understand. I'm here on a visa, so I can relate to most of them a lot. So honestly, I feel like I owe most of my success to that because I feel like they can really relate to me. They're like, I like that I can speak my first language with you. And that's actually one of the main reasons I connected to your office, because you had a lot of Spanish-speaking employees that could help my clients. So that was one of the main reasons that I was like, okay, I think I can work with them.
Yeah, Martin, you speak Spanish, right? What percentage of our staff speaks Spanish? Probably 80%?
Yeah.
Wow.
If not more.
I didn't know it was that high.
I think there's one that doesn't. They're learning here.
Interesting.
Adam, you speak Spanish. Have you felt that it's helped bridge some gaps for you with clients that
I think it helps.
Are uncomfortable, like they speak English, but are more comfortable speaking Spanish?
Yeah. A lot of times they'll just speak Spanish and I speak English. A lot of times they understand English.
Mm-hmm.
And so they can speak Spanish and I speak English back and we're totally fine. If I need to speak Spanish, then I'll speak it, but I prefer not to.
But you can understand it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And estate planning is so, it can be scary for most of my clients. But when I tell them, oh, there's this group of people that can help you in your own language, they're like, oh, really? And that's what really encourages them to reach out to you.
Yeah, we've been working more. We focus a lot on community education to help people understand what their options are and that it's not as daunting of a process as they think to get their affairs in order. And Adam's been working on getting that done in Spanish. Where do we stand on that?
It's almost done. I think we've got the script all done and all that. And the ladies have actually, they dubbed it.
They've recorded.
I thought you guys used it, didn't you, at Trilogy? You remember that? You and Gonzalo?
When we did the webinar?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I think Savannah did like a dub over or something. Yes. Maybe she recorded it all.
I don't know. She did a Spanish version.
Yeah.
Okay. So what other parts of your childhood really shaped and were the building blocks for where you're at now?
I guess definitely what we were talking about having, you know, that U.S. exposure, just coming a lot and seeing everything. I never really planned on moving here ever.
Mm-hmm. How often did you come?
Like I said, every like a couple months, but I never.
When you were young?
Yeah.
Like how young?
Very young, because I live 3 hours away from the border.
Mm-hmm.
So we would come all the time. And also, like I said, my mom's side of the family lives in Yuma.
Mm.
So I would come all the time just to see everyone. We would spend Christmas here and stuff. So, yes. But anyway, that was a huge point or like building block to where I'm now.
Uh-huh.
But what else? Probably just like seeing my dad be a business owner. I think that really shaped me.
What type of business?
He has, so where I'm from, everyone has like a ranch and cattle and stuff. So he has a business that, he also has a ranch and cattle, but he has a business that kind of like sells things for the ranch owners and stuff. So kind of like seeing him always as a business owner, I never see any of my parents as employees. So I feel like that kind of really shaped me as well. Even though I'm an employee right now, I do feel like I'm building my practice as a business owner.
Yeah.
And I never saw myself as a 9-to-5 employee ever.
Yeah. So you determine your own schedule. You look for your own clients.
Yes.
Based on your performance, you get compensated.
Mm-hmm.
You think a person, I've been thinking about this lately. Yeah, I think you're touching on it because I wanted to have a conversation with my kids. Like you might be, this is what I found is as we have clients come in, seems like the most wealth that we see are those that are entrepreneurs or they've got their own businesses. Mm-hmm. Would you
200% agree with that? With my clients, the ones that are most wealthy are business owners.
Why do you think that is?
Why?
Yeah.
Well, you know why you're business owners. I guess you can make more money when you're an employee. You just get a very specific amount and growth is very limited. But yeah, when you're a business owner, you can keep most of the profit, I guess.
Mm-hmm. You control it. I think, and we see the success stories, I guess you could say, because they're coming to us to get planning done, both financially on your side and then estate planning on our side. And so we see kind of the better successes, but that doesn't mean just because I'm going to go out on my own and do my own thing, I'm going to be successful.
Yes.
Usually it means you're going to fail. That honestly, you've got an 80% chance of failure. And so only 1 in 5 business attempts succeed. But that doesn't mean don't go into business. It means do it 5 times and then you'll hit the odds, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've been through roller coasters where we've worked for a couple of months and at the end of the quarter paid in a lot of money afterwards to have worked that quarter because it wasn't a profitable quarter. But then we looked at it, made some tweaks, learned as to what we needed to do, and made it so we could actually provide for our families the next quarter.
Yes. And you also have employees that you're responsible for, right? And they have to support their families and stuff. So it's a lot of pressure.
It is pressure. And for me, it's actually part of the satisfaction of the job. Because I think that a lot of times I think I could come in and be an employee and not have all the responsibilities of balancing the bills that are to be paid and the advertising that has to be done and the constant recruiting of new clients and just do the work. And that might be an easier lifestyle. But I really enjoy the fact that we can help people come to an environment where they learn, they grow, they participate in, you know, something that is productive for society, and they go home satisfied and having earned something for themselves where they can be self-sustaining. That to me really is, and I know it sounds cliche, but it really is the most fulfilling part of working as a small business owner.
Wow.
Adam, how do you feel?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I wanted to ask, how did you get into financial planning? So you grew up in Mexico, but you were coming back and forth during that. And then when did you decide, hey, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get into financial planning and I'm going to move to Phoenix.
Yes. So I always say like life brought me here. I never planned on it. Like I said, when I moved to the US, I decided to move a day before. I was like, okay, I guess I'll move. So everything started when I was picking my major for college. I was like, okay, what pays more? And I was like, finance. So that's literally why I went to the finance major. I finished that. And then my dad was really kind of like encouraging me to get a master's. He's like, you need to get a master's. It's like not optional. Just get it right now. Get that out of the way. Like, don't wait. So I was like, what should I do? Okay, I guess a master in finance. So I applied to the master's in finance, U of A, and I was like, should I do it? Should I not do it? I got accepted like right away. And then it was like a day before classes started and I was like, should I go? Should I not go? And I was like, okay, I guess I'll go. So I just like packed everything and moved to U of A, got my master's. And I always wanted to work in something related to investments. I found the stock market fascinating. I was like, there's not a boring day ever in the market. And that's what I didn't want. I didn't want like a boring, repetitive job.
Mm-hmm.
I love numbers, but I didn't want to do accounting because of that. So I was like, I want to work in something related to the stock market. So I always knew I wanted to do kind of like investment planning or something of that sort. So when I got my master's and then I started applying for jobs because everyone in my class was doing that. So I was like, okay, I guess I'll do that. And I couldn't get hired in the Tucson area because that's where I wanted to be. I couldn't find a job. So I was like, okay, I need to expand my radio a little bit. So I was like, okay, Phoenix area. Within like the first week I started applying, I got hired by Trilogy. And it was like financial investment planning. I was like, oh, this is exactly what I want. So I started that, and then I quickly realized it had nothing to do with investments. It was more like consulting and talking to people. And mm-hmm. then I realized I really loved that. So that's how I got into it. So I got both kind of like talking to people and building relationships, which I love, but a little bit of portfolio consulting, management, and numbers, which I love as well. I thought it was like the perfect mix. So I've been doing that ever since, and I've never thought, literally not even one day I thought about switching or doing something else.
Have you ever had an itch to like get more into the investment side, like day trading or anything like that?
Or no.
Not at all?
No, not at all.
That's not your personality?
I don't think so, no.
But that's what you thought when you went into finance, right? You thought, Okay, you know, Wall Street and yelling out bids for different types of stocks and buying and selling and making your clients rich. But in the end, you become something totally different that understands that aspect of it, but really is not appealing to you once you truly understand how it works.
Correct. Also, I was 20, 21. You want something that's exciting.
Yeah.
But once you're older.
And that sounds exciting too.
Yeah.
Because I know that a big part of becoming a lawyer was like, yeah, that sounds like a respectable profession. Well, maybe. Now that I say it out loud, doesn't sound so much so. I thought of litigating. I thought of going to court every day. I thought of arguing my clients' cases. And it's similar to your story. In reality, we do very little of that. We do majority of understanding what our clients need and figuring it out. Sometimes helping them figure out what they don't know themselves, but ultimately what is going to get them to help out their family and obtain peace of mind right now. So it took me, for example, a client came in yesterday and just wanted to talk about the difference between an irrevocable and a revocable trust, which is kind of a nuanced issue in a trust. It's not that big of an issue. It should take 5 minutes to talk about, but that was what the appointment was about. And I thought, there's something more to this. And as we walked through the appointment, we found out that they had done some genealogy and they had done some DNA tests and found out that there were some other family members out there, and they wanted to provide for those family members, and they had written their own addendum or codicil to their estate plan, and that's what they were going to use to care or provide for these other family members that were out there, that they have embraced the fact that they were family and they didn't want to leave them out. And I said, no, that's not going to be the best way to do it. Let's do it, you know, in the pattern that you've been doing before, this formalized trust that's going to avoid probate. But it took an hour to get to that point that that's really what they were concerned about, and for them to pull this paper out of their purse that they had drafted.
Wow. I think going to what you said, I think Sean and I both experienced In the legal profession, you have, as you start off, it's like you feel like, oh, I'm going to work in that high rise in New York City and wear the suit and slick back hair. Right, Sean? You were thinking that.
I was.
You were. And then I was lucky enough to follow Sean's lead because he had already been through law school. He'd come and he'd practice for a few years. And I was able to see maybe that life of the high rise New York fast paced gruel. It's kind of like alluring, but at the same time, or even better, what I was able to see was lifestyle really matters, especially with a wife and children. And do I want that, or do I want Yuma, which is where I can be comfortable, I can be happy, and I can still make money as a business owner and have more free time to be with my family and my kids rather than the rat race of a metropolitan area. And so luckily I had Sean to lead the way. And I didn't get sucked into that portal, because a lot of people do. They go to law school and they feel like, oh, I'm gonna be working in that high rise in downtown Phoenix or something like that.
Yeah.
And when they get there, they only last maybe 2-3 years and get burned out because this is such a grueling thing. And those big firms do that on purpose. They want to weed out those that are not gonna make them the most money. And so they put these kids coming out of law school through everything.
Yeah. It's an 80-hour work week minimum right off the bat.
Yeah.
So you went through that, Sean?
No, he didn't.
Just as an intern for a bit.
In Kentucky, right?
Yeah.
You got a taste of big law.
Mm-hmm. And did that for 2 years. And then afterwards, it was a big question as to whether or not to stay and work in either Cincinnati or Louisville, Kentucky. And those were the two primary draws for the law students graduating. And it was difficult. If you don't start in as an intern, then it's really difficult to get a well-paying job. You got to start at the very bottom, small firm. You're making not even enough to pay your student loans. And so we're, you know, going back and forth between that. And my wife's like, well, what about Arizona? And I'm like, I don't know. You know, I remember when we left Arizona, we looked at Yuma in the rearview mirror and thought, never again. And so we came and talked to some of the business owners, and it did. It just felt right. It felt like this. There was a lot of you can have a good family work-life balance. And and there were so many opportunities. I could choose from different firms instead of just accepting whatever offer came my way. And that ultimately was the way we go, and it would take a lot to get me out of Yuma. I love Yuma.
Really?
Now. Yeah, it would take, I don't know. I don't know if I could be bought out of Yuma at this point.
That's interesting. Do you feel the same way, Adam, about Yuma?
Yeah, well, yeah, we're ingrained in Yuma now. So, yeah, I wouldn't. I like to visit other places. I mean, San Diego is fantastic right now, but.
You're right. You're close to really good, cool places.
Yeah. So we can jump down to Mexico. We can jump up to Phoenix or over to San Diego. Vegas, if you really want, you know, a party.
How far is Vegas from here?
Five hours.
Yeah.
5 hours. Okay, I think that's the same distance from Phoenix.
Yeah, about that. So it's just a great little, I think, gem that people don't know about, and I like to keep it that way.
Yeah, me too. I want to hear more about you growing up and your childhood. What did it look like?
I think I really did have a good childhood. It was very chill. We went on family vacations all the time, and we all enjoyed it. I have two sisters. So the five of us just, like, really enjoyed our family vacations. We would go, I don't know, skiing during the winter, and then during the summer we would go to California. I don't know. Like I said, we would spend a lot of time in the U.S. I never really got to kind of, like, see Mexico when I was younger. I started seeing Mexico when I got older because I'm like, I want to see the beaches in Mexico. So I started doing that by myself with my friends. But growing up, yeah, I think I had a really good childhood. The schools in Mexico can be really good, like bilingual schools, which I think that really helped and shaped me. But yeah, family time was really important for me. And
do you have a big family?
Like I said, two sisters, but I don't have like a lot of cousins or a big family.
Okay.
Besides that, yes. It was mostly like the five of us.
Did you participate in your parents' business? Did you work there? Did you brand the cattle? Did you?
Nothing. And if you ask me details, like, what does he do? I'm like, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we never got involved at all. Yeah. Which is interesting because I know
you were to
kids,
do it again, would you?
If I had the choice.
Yeah. Now, would you get more involved and learn what they did and just understand how your parents put food on the table?
I think I would. Yes. But I don't think it was a personal choice. I think my parents didn't want us to like get really involved. They want us to have just like a really happy childhood. Like I didn't work until I was out of college. Like I never worked, which is very different from here. I know in the U.S., people start working from like very early. So it was just like a different culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did you do to keep out of trouble?
Keep out of trouble. I was just a good girl since the beginning.
But what did you do with your free time? You can't be studying all the time.
Yes. No, I had a lot of hobbies. I did horse show jumping all my life. Which took a lot of my time.
Okay.
Yes. And like I said last time, I danced ballet, and I did that when I was younger too. So I was just like doing my hobbies all day.
Mm. Yeah. When you went back, you said you just got back from vacation down there. Were you down in Hermosillo or did you go somewhere else in Mexico?
No, I was in Italy.
Oh, you went to Italy?
Yes.
Very cool. You speak Italian?
I don't.
You look like you could be Italian, though.
Really?
Yeah.
At least a couple of people told me that. But I don't speak Italian. I wish I learned Italian before going. When I was there, I was like, I wish I knew how to order in Italian.
Yeah, but you basically can get it done.
You understood it, right?
That's why I didn't learn, because I was like, oh, I can get away with just like, I know Spanish, but yeah. No. Like,
really?
No.
Really?
Yeah. Like, I understand a little bit, but not really. I tried to speak Spanish and then someone spoke Italian to me and we couldn't communicate.
Really?
So what was the, did you revert to English?
Yes, I would speak mostly English.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So you got back from Italy. I thought you went down to Mexico. So I was going to say, do you think it's safe? We went a couple years ago. Yeah, it's 2 years now with our kids. And that was kind of an ordeal. We went down to like the Cancun area, not in Cancun proper, but beyond that in Playa del Carmen. And so getting ready for this trip, like we talked to the kids, hey, you know, you can get stolen. So
that's a possibility.
It is a possibility. So this is what we do, you know, go for the soft parts of the tissue.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So do you have any fears like that when you go down to Mexico?
It's funny because I didn't used to when I was living there. I felt so safe.
Yeah.
But now every time I go, I do feel unsafe.
But you grew up in the country though, right?
It's a small city.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Like, I got the impression like Yuma out. Small city or like San Luis?
Like a million city. People small city.
that's small.
Small city compared to like Mexico City or something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like
okay.
That. Yeah.
I got the impression you're on the outskirts, like a finca.
No. It was nothing like that.
Okay.
But I do feel unsafe, especially like as a young woman.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I drive there by myself and I'm scared.
Yeah.
The whole time.
Martial arts or any type of...
No.
You do Pilates.
Yeah, but it's not the same.
No.
No, it's not the same.
It'll keep you healthy.
Hold on. I'm going to do downward dog. Back off.
Yes, like, that's not going to help. But I do feel unsafe. Like, I don't even stop to, like, go to the bathroom or get a coffee until I get home.
Uh-huh.
I do feel unsafe driving there.
Years ago, we went down to... where'd we go? Rocky Point, Puerto Peñasco. And so we went down here through this port of entry and we went horizontally across, like following the border, you know, and then like the Sonoida and then down. But about midway, there was a stop and you don't know if they're like federales or if they really are or they're not, because they've got their machine guns. And so they stopped us and it was pretty intimidating because you can't do anything about it.
Was it federales?
I hope so. You know, we stopped and they checked our vehicles and stuff like that. And we went on our way. But yeah, you just never know. Is it cartel? Is it, even if it might be both, it could be federales. They're part of the cartel. You know, you just never know. Do you think it's getting cleaned up a little bit down there?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
I don't think so, yeah.
With the new president, you don't think she's getting it done?
I think she's doing good things. I do like her, but I don't know. There's still a lot of violence and stuff that you see every day in the news.
Oh, really?
How do her and Trump get along?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think they get along well. He said good things about her being a respectable woman and stuff, but I don't think she's very happy and friendly.
With him?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because is she more liberal?
Yes, she's very, very liberal.
Oh, okay. What do you think about what's going on in Guatemala with... the crackdown on the gangs and how they've been super severe on any gang members or any gang related crimes and increase those punishments. So it's basically eliminated the gang factor in, I think it's Guatemala. Maybe it's El Salvador.
El
Salvador. But Guatemala did it as well too. I think they're adopting.
MS-13.
Yes. Some of the similar.
Are you familiar with that at all?
No. To eliminate gangs.
Gangs, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, MS-13, they went hard. Well, they built that big prison and that's, and then they just threw everybody in it. Like if you get wind of somebody being part of the gang, then you're in prison.
Yeah, any really gang related activity, especially tattoos or things like that.
You can't have a tattoo.
Not a gang related tattoo. Yeah.
And they go door to door, like basically investigating, have the men pull up their shirts and look for tattoos. You got a tattoo that connects you to MS-13, then they take you right then.
Wow. Yeah, it's intense. I watched, and you know, documentaries, you got to take with a grain of salt, but they had their own independent like societies out in the desolate area of the country. And they were self-supporting, and a lot of the typical inmates, you know, that were convicted of your, you know, theft or whatever, were overseeing a lot of these gang members, and the gang members weren't allowed to speak at all. And if the normal inmates were caught communicating with them or trying to, you know, give them any type of information, then they would be convicted of a gang related crime, and which puts them in the same position. And so it was like they were very, very strict, and it just looked like that's not anything that I would ever want to get involved in. And that's why I can see that there's a lot of fear of individuals that have come across a border in the past 4 or 5 years that had participated in those type of gangs, that are very scared of getting deported and becoming, you know, interned in those types of facilities.
They've even gone, like, I don't know if we saw the same one, but it was on YouTube. I don't know. but this documentary, like, they go from cemetery to cemetery, and if there's any MS-13 members in there, they destroy the headstones, everything.
Really?
Wow.
Annihilating any. Yeah. And so you watch and you're like, okay, the result is there is basically no crime now or any gang activity. However, in the wake of all that, a lot of people that are in prison shouldn't be there. They're not, they never were part of it.
That, and the government has to be almost totalitarian to be able to enforce that kind of strict laws. There's not a lot of due process.
And that's the joys of living here in the United States. Right? And so you look at it, it comes at a real extreme cost. It's like you gather in everybody, throwing them in prison, then you ask questions later. But really that never happens. So people just spend years and years in prison that shouldn't be there. They didn't do anything wrong. But here in the U.S., we have due process, which is, you know, fantastic. In Mexico, it's a different legal system. It's civil law. So here it's you're innocent until proven guilty. There you're guilty till proven innocent, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're the attorney. So what I've heard about when people get, you know, like they go to this detention centers for people that cross the border legally.
Yeah.
Something about them not having a trial anymore. So what is that? What does that mean?
Well, so what was
not a right for trial.
And I don't know all the details about it, but just, you know, seeing the clips that I have seen is when they crossed the border, they were given, and this was mainly run by the cartels. They would pay the cartels money to get them both to and across the border and to provide them all the information that they needed to apply for asylum. And so you apply for asylum and your name's recorded, whatever name you provide, and you're given a court date, which is typically 18 months, 2 years down the road. And so then you're released, and you're supposed to have some type of sponsor that you're released to, like somebody that's
an address.
Yeah. A U.S. citizen that says, yes, I will be responsible for making sure this person shows up to their court date. But the cartels also established that. They established the individuals that would say who their name was and what their address was, but it was false information that they were providing. And so it was just this whole big sod that was set up to get people across the border. And so it provided billions of dollars to the cartels. They became very powerful in getting individuals across the border. In fact, if you try to encroach in their business, it was kind of like encroaching in, you know, a cocaine business or some other type of drug business. Like, they would do away with you very quickly. So anyways, a lot of people got across the border and then would miss their court date purposely. And just like, once we're here, we're going to get some type of amnesty or something's going to happen where we're going to get citizenship, fast tracked to it. And with the new administration, they're saying, no, if you miss your court date or if you're here illegally, we're looking for people that are criminals. But generally, if you're a criminal and you're an illegal, then you might be associated with a whole bunch of other people that are here illegally. And if we find the criminal and the other people are here that are not necessarily criminals or charged with a crime, we're going to take them all. And so they're going to the detention facilities And yeah, there's, you know, 30 people per room, and there's a toilet and a sink, and it's pretty limited facilities. But the question is, are they getting due process? Meaning, are we going through all the steps of establishing whether or not they've committed a crime? And the answer that the administration gives is, just by being here illegally, that's it. Like, and they're not American citizens, so they don't get all the constitutional protections that American citizen gets. And so they're going to these facilities and saying, listen, you can go back home, or you can wait for your court date to determine whether or not asylum that you're seeking really is a valid reason to be here. And that's what I understand. That's in a nutshell what I understand is happening.
I think the question is, how legally, you know, how much due process is afforded to a person that's not a citizen of the United States? Because the Constitution, due process is a constitutional principle.
Yeah, and just dissect that word for a second, due process, because people hear it a lot, but they don't really understand what it means, like probate, you know? So what's due process?
Due process, so I have a right to face my accuser and know what charges are coming against me, and I have a right to, an attorney, and to plead the fifth, where I can, if it's going to be incriminated, I feel like I'm going to be incriminated, then I don't have to answer questions. And then I also have the ability to cross-examine my accuser. Mm-hmm. And then what was the other one that came to mind?
You're presumed innocent until proven guilty. Yeah. But again,
so if you're not an American citizen, you don't.
Well, that's the question. So that's the question. We have allowed, I think this is my personal opinion. I don't know if it's true or not, but this is my personal opinion, is that we have afforded limited due process to non-citizens. Mm. And so that's where the rub is where you have an administration, one president comes in, and they're in charge of, federally, they're in charge of immigration, you know, and the borders. And so they can, by the stroke of a pen, dictate how that's kind of managed policy-wise. The law is the law. Federally, there's laws on the book that say if you cross the border and you're not allowed, you don't have a reason to be here, you don't have a visa or some other valid reason for being here, then you've violated this statute, and now that's a crime, and so these other things can happen. But you have one administration that enforces that more than another. Mm-hmm.
You think about it, if you or I were to cross into Mexico illegally and the federales found out and arrested us, I'd be like, I would presume that I would be prosecuted for committing a crime by entering into their sovereign territory illegally. And the reverse is true. If somebody didn't, like, even if as a citizen, I went around the port of entry and went over the fence or under the fence or through the fence or whatever it might be, and came back into the country without going through the designated port of entry, that's a crime. And I would suspect that I should be thrown in jail and prosecuted for that crime. Even though I am an American citizen and I am entitled to live here, I've got to go through the port of entry to get here and to leave here.
When I got married, and this is like 2006, we went on our honeymoon down in Cozumel. And so we got a flight down there and all this stuff, you know, but we drove over to Tijuana to go and fly from there down to Cancun. And then we took a little ferry over to Cozumel. And on our way back, we were there for probably like a week, I think, maybe 5-7 days, something like that, maybe 10 days, I don't know. And on our way back, so we flew back from Cancun to Tijuana, and we had parked there in Tijuana at the airport. And, you know, it was a great vacation. It was fun, our honeymoon, and we're coming back. And so we were going to leave the airport. And as we're leaving, these guys with machine guns, like, stopped us. And they said, let me see your visa. And I was like, we don't have a visa. They're like, well, how long were you here? And I said, how many days? And they're like, well, you need a visa. And I thought they were trying to shake us down. Mm-hmm. I thought it was like a...
Okay, because you knew you didn't need one.
Well, yeah. So we just kind of pushed through and kept walking. And they were like yelling at us. And we're like, in my mind, I'm like, I'm running to the car and just like taking off. you know, just get to the U.S. side.
Really? I didn't even hear this.
They didn't pursue us. And I get back and like I look it up. And yeah, we had to have a visa because we were there more days. And we went beyond the border region, you know.
Okay.
We went beyond Sonora and we went down to Cancun for longer than just, you know, allowed. And
didn't
so
know
they,
that.
Yeah. I don't know if it's changed since then, but it could have been really bad for us.
Did you get a visa for Cancun or no?
No, I didn't get a visa because I was like, we're not going to be there that long. Okay. I thought I was going under the, I was under the impression that in beach zones and in Sonora, like certain mileage, I think 250 miles from the border region for the border itself, you don't need a visa for a certain amount of days, like, you know, like 3 months or something. And that might be true, but it wasn't true down in the Cancun area if you went beyond that region. But I didn't know that at the time. And so going to what Sean was saying, like had they pursued us, like we would have been in jail. They don't ask questions, they don't treat you nicely. Hey, here's your court date, you know, two years down the road,
please come back.
Yeah, no, here's a cell phone and here's some walk around money.
So
the guys that stopped you, were they really policemen that actually asking for your visa? You never knew.
I don't know. They're in full camo, you know, uniforms, and they had the machine guns and the all that stuff. And they're in the airport, so it's like,
so
I don't know.
You just ran away from them.
Yeah. Okay. Fast walked away. Because at this point, I've been traveling all day. Okay. It might have been like midnight because we were poor, so we're taking like red eye flights the whole time. So we were exhausted, and it's like, I'm not dealing with this right now. That was my attitude. It's like, I'm not dealing with this.
With the military right now, I can't deal with
it. I'm like, dude, we have no money to pay you or bribe you. I don't, I'm just out of here. And like I said, in my mind, I'm like,
who was with you?
Just Jessica, me and Jessica.
Oh, okay.
And she was really upset with me already because on the way, when we were going through security, she had this little Leatherman, and I don't know how I had it. Somehow I had it in my possession. And they confiscated it. And she had that since she was like a girl. And so she's been upset about that ever since.
Ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She still brings it up. Her Leatherman.
Do you feel like, okay, so there's a lot of buzz, and maybe this is a too touchy of a subject, that people are being stereotyped and they're being unfairly focused on by the Border Patrol as being here illegally. Do you feel like you've been subject to that?
Me personally?
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think I've been lucky enough to not being subject to
Why?
That.
Why? Because when you get to those border checks, do they just wave you through or do they...
Oh, when I come back?
No. Like, you know, if you're going over to San Diego, there's a border check, and sometimes... Yeah. If you're going, you know, throughout certain parts of Arizona, most of them have been shut down now. I know the one coming out of Yuma and Welton has been shut down for a while. Yes. But they would, you know, certain people, they would, you know, have you roll down the window and they'd chat with you. And certain people, they just wave you on through. So have you experienced that? Have you been to San Diego at least recently?
I've experienced both. Sometimes I do get just like waved down, even though I have Mexican like car plates.
Oh, okay.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Maybe I don't look dangerous. I don't know. But sometimes they do just ask for my visa and I just show it real quick and they're like, okay, you can go. So I don't know. Like, I don't know what their judgment comes from. I don't know.
When I put my window down, they're usually like, are you a citizen? Yeah. So what do you say? No.
I say no. But I always have my visa ready. Like, no, just like that. And they're like, okay, you can go.
Okay.
But I've had no issues. Mm-hmm. And actually getting out of the country... When I went to Italy 2 weeks ago, I was anxious the entire time because I'm like, am I going to be able to come back to the country?
Mm-hmm.
And the whole entire trip, I was just planning my plan B. I'm like, okay, if I can't come back, then I'll just do this and this and this and this and this. So yeah, it's kind of scary getting out of the country because you never know.
I want to hear your plan B.
What?
I want to hear plan B.
It's not good. I was just like, I'll just stay in Hermosillo. Stay in Hermosillo and like... do Pilates and stuff like that all day.
Oh, like you would never be allowed back in the country.
Yeah, I
like
had a
plan B career.
Because you never know.
Wow.
You literally never. Did you work down there remotely?
No.
No.
If you're working for a U.S. company, you need a visa. Mm-hmm.
Right. But can you be in Mexico and do work while on your laptop?
No.
Not for the company you're with?
No.
Because?
Because, no, you can't work. Even if you're... remote, you're still physically somewhere else.
Mm.
How do you do your taxes? Because we have a tax treaty with Mexico, right? So you just file your taxes here in the U.S. like
just here,
normal, and then you let Mexico know, hey.
I don't let them know because I don't have any income there or anything at all. Okay. So I don't have to report
it. So their tax system isn't like ours where you get taxed globally. It doesn't matter where you are. If you're a citizen, you get taxed.
No, it's not like that.
Do you have, so, okay. Man, what was the other question I wanted to ask as you were talking? So your passport is a Mexican passport. And
I thought your plan B was like to get back in the country another way, but that's what I was looking to hear.
No.
So the visa just keeps, how often do you have to get that?
I renew it every 4 years.
Oh, not bad. And you just have to have proof that you're still working for an American company.
Are you looking to apply for citizenship?
I don't know. I think that's something I still think about, but I don't know. You have to go through the process of like applying for the green card and then for the citizenship.
So if it was like a 3-month process where all you had to establish is that you didn't have a rap sheet, basically you hadn't committed any crimes, you were a productive citizen, you could support yourself, and that was it. So like what normal people would expect to have any type of entrance into organized, like I don't know, like the bar, to take the bar exam, you have to prove those types of things. And it's like a 3-month process.
Character and fitness.
Yeah, it's called a character and fitness exam. So if it was kind of like a character and fitness exam, just making sure you're just not this part of a criminal cartel, would you do it?
Yes, if it was easy and simple, I definitely would do it. But it's definitely not easy and simple. It's a very long process, yes.
So that's what prevents you from just even going down that road. See, and that's what's so discouraging is because we want more people like you. We want to attract talent like you into this country, and we want to make that process easy. And the problem is we make it so difficult that people take the alternative. I would take the alternative route. I would get to this country
really,
no matter how whatever means it took to get to this country. Absolutely. No, I don't know much about Mexico other than the rumors that I hear and this and that. And so obviously maybe it would be different if I actually lived there and was able to have the same quality of life. But if I believe that it was a better quality of life for my family, hey, my primary objective is to provide for my family. I'm getting here. Yeah. And then I'll worry about the repercussions later.
What's the benefit of a green card over a visa?
With a green card, well, with a visa, I can only work for one company, do one thing. So I don't have the option to like, oh, I don't like this company, I'm going to switch, or I'm getting a better offer somewhere else. I do not get that option at all. What else? I have to renew it every 4 years. So every 4 years, I need to prove.
Still working.
That I'm still working and that I should be here. And like immigration rules change like this.
Yeah.
Like maybe next year my visa is like non-existent, my type of visa. So you never know. So you're kind of always up in the air. That's why I have my plan B, because I'm like, I never know what's going to happen. And with a green card, you just know you're staying. So you can work for any company, do whatever you want. Right now, my job has to be very specific. But if I had a green card, I could do something else.
How hard is it to get a green card?
It's hard, yes, because you need a very specific work visa, so you can apply for the green card later. To get that work visa, it is a lottery. So I've had friends that it takes them years to actually...
The lottery?
Yes. That's
ridiculous.
It is a lottery. There is a limited amount of people that can get it every year.
Talk about not being meritocratic. Right?
Yes. It's hard.
So, yeah, it just seems to me that the people that deserve to be here, that want to work, that want to be productive, should have a clear path. We need to make that the first priority, and then we can address, okay, stopping all of the illegal entry. Because if you're going to make it too difficult to come here legally, then where there's a will, there's a way. People are going to get here. And people like me, there's lots of people like me that have that same type of mentality, and I don't disagree with it. they're going to get here. And if they've got a legitimate path, great, I'll take it. If I don't, I'll take the alternative plan. My plan B would be, okay, which cartel charges the least?
If there was an option to buy it, buy citizenship, would you do that?
I would, yes.
Depending on how
if
much.
If I had the money, yes.
Yeah, this whole $1 million, is it a million that Trump was offering for the gold pass?
Something. I don't know the value, but this isn't, it's not a foreign concept. There's other locations.
That's like, ridiculous.
It's a very typical thing to do in like tax haven
locations.
Oh.
Nevis Island and things like that. You buy your citizenship and then have complete
like freedom there.
Yeah. You know, you can't talk about at one point not selling out to China and at the other point, yeah, if you got $1 million and you get your citizenship. It's like that's selling out.
Well, imagine there's still some vetting going on.
Well,
you jump the line. I don't know.
Is that a thing though?
He floated the idea.
Oh, he floated.
He did. And he said that, yeah, we were going to make a bunch of money from it. And we're going to get a bunch of good people from it. But that equates money to good people. And I don't think that they necessarily equate at all.
I mean, as I was
thinking. It's going to be dirty money.
I was thinking about it. I'm like, well, like in your case where maybe you don't have $1 million cash to do that, but maybe there could be a program. I'm just spitballing here that you're working, like your life is here and you're contributing to this country. And so maybe a little bit of every paycheck gets to go towards this magic number. You know, maybe it's $500,000 or something. And when you hit that, then you get full citizenship. But then I'm thinking, wait a second, you're already paying taxes. So
yeah,
you're already taking out money.
That's what taxes are for.
Like, what the heck?
No. Right? Yeah, I don't think that any type of you buy your way in.
Really?
No. I think it all has to be with demonstrate that you are a productive citizen, that you're not a criminal. That's it. Anything else, I mean, it's kind of like a poll tax for voting, right? That what they did is they did that for racial discrimination because at the time in the South, there was a lot of black people that couldn't pay the poll tax, and so then they couldn't vote. And that's where this whole voter ID comes in. They've kind of like twisted that concept and said, well, yeah, that was what they were doing in the South is they were trying to prevent people from voting by having these special requirements, and they lumped in IDs with the poll tax, which is totally different. An ID doesn't cost anything or cost a minimal amount, and any person that is going to participate in society needs to have an ID, whereas a poll tax was specifically to discriminate against a minority voter. And I don't think that any type of monetary investment should be involved in getting here. I think it's just solely on, are you a hard worker? Are you going to contribute? Let's do it. Are you somebody that's got a criminal past? Get to the end of the line.
How do you demonstrate that you're not going to be? I think the challenge that we run into is the social welfare programs that we have, that we offer. And so it's like, I think it's one or the other. This is just my personal opinion. Either you have social welfare programs and you have a robust immigration, filter that disallows people, making it hard for them to come here and gain citizenship, or you get rid of the social welfare programs and then you open the border because there is no one at that point. There's no weight on the rest of the society.
Yeah,
the tax money is not supporting people just flowing in.
Right. I think that's what rubs a lot of people wrong is when people come in and live off the welfare system but don't pay into the tax.
So, I mean, because if you think about it, our ancestors that came here, my great-great-grandfather came through Ellis Island. He signed a ledger. You know, he had a sponsor in Illinois, in Chicago, and so he had to have a sponsor, and he wrote that down, that address, and then he went to Illinois and then made his way to Seattle and built a business and things like that. And then the rest of the generations came into being, but that was 1905. And so that was prior to social welfare programs where we were saying, hey, the best and brightest of the world, this is America, come here.
Yeah.
You have the Statue of Liberty, you know, Ellis Island welcoming you here. And that wasn't an issue because I tried to reconcile, well, why was it working then? Or what did we do then that we're not doing now? And why is it so difficult now? And that's the ultimate conclusion that I've come to is that, well, we didn't have social welfare back then. That didn't come about until like the FDR.
But also, I don't think it's only the social welfare. It's also like the job market. there's a lot of people here already. And it's a huge thing right now. And it's also something that really, one of the reasons that make it harder for professionals like me to come here and stay is that we're practically taking someone else's job.
Which is fine. You know? I think that's good. If you're better qualified to give me financial advice,
yeah,
I want you. I don't want somebody that just happened to be born in America.
I know, but that's an argument.
Why?
A separate argument besides the social welfare.
But I don't think it's that much different than eugenics. And I'll tell you why. Because the choosing... Huh?
The big word.
Well, eugenics is the
idea. What is that?
It's the idea that one race or one society is better than another race or society. And that's exactly what we're doing. We're saying American citizens are more qualified than foreigners. And it's ridiculous. We've proven that again and again. It's inhumane. I want the best person that's worked the hardest or that can provide the best service. That's what the capitalistic system is built off of. And whoever can provide me the best service or product at the best price gets my business. And I voluntarily go to that person and voluntarily give them my money in exchange for their product or service. Whereas anything else where the government gets involved in that exchange results in reduced quality services and reduced quality products. So if the government gets involved in who is allowed to give me that service or product, whether or not they're a foreigner or they're a natural born citizen, then that is, I think, interrupting my ability to contract and look for the best deal.
Is that happening though? So for example, if there's another financial planner that's an American citizen, a US citizen, and they do the same kind of stuff that you do, and there's this job opening, and so there's you and there's a citizen, are they allowed, is the company allowed to say, or are they mandated to say, we've got to go with the citizen before we go with Carolina, who has a work visa?
200%, yes. Because a work
really
visa, are they mandated to do that, or are they
most of the
or are they incentive like yeah.
They're not mandated, but most of the companies have in the job description, we need someone that is a resident or U.S. citizen.
Yeah,
which means they don't want someone with a U.S. visa. They don't want someone with a work permit because that could be expensive for them in the long
run. There you
well,
go.
No. So if there's a legitimate expense related to the company, then that's that company's decision. But I don't think it should be a government decision, which it ultimately is, because the government is what's making it expensive.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
It's. I mean, they're free to hire whoever they want.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I think the main reason it took me a while to find a job was that little small letters at the end that said you can't apply if you're not a U.S. citizen or resident.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that is similar. It's right up there with their saying you can't apply if you're not this racial background or this ethnicity or this religious or this, I don't know, sexual orientation. It's like, no. Am I qualified? Okay, I'm applying. And everything else should be thrown out the window, and the government should not interfere.
It's interesting because you're living in like this limbo. Mm-hmm. And it'd be very, very challenging if I were in your shoes. But legally, like as you're talking, it's like all these issues are just firing off in my mind of like, man, because the US has given you, they're like, hey, come, you know, here's your work visa. We want you to be here. But you're like handicapped. You can't do this.
Yeah, it's almost
like
you're a felon or something.
Right. It's like we're watching you, and you know, you can't really spread your wings and fly like you could if you were a US citizen. So we're giving we're allowing you to do all these things. We give you certain rights, but at the same time, my question is, well, what constitutional rights do you have? Because you're not a US citizen. And so does the Constitution, have we allowed the Constitution to extend to visa holders or to green card holders? And to how much do we allow the Constitution to protect you like it protects a normal U.S. citizen? Those are really interesting questions, because if I were in your shoes, I'd be like, hey, when I saw that little blurb at the very bottom of that hiring advertisement, I would have an argument, well, this is unconstitutional because I have, you're preventing me from getting this job, and that's basically racial profiling, or it's on my nationality. You know, that is against the Constitution. We can't discriminate on nationality.
And other things as well that actually do cause financial hardships to companies. For example, if we asked somebody if they were pregnant or intending to become pregnant, and they said yes, and we said, well, okay, we really don't want to hire you because that's going to interrupt your ability to work for us, we'd be sued.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like it or not, I think that it's better to go that route. Like, look at the candidate in front of you, make your best judgment, only ask them questions that qualify them for the job. That's it.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope sometimes, but I find it fascinating. After this interview, I'm going to start digging in.
Really good questions. You need to tell me what do you find out?
I will. I'm really curious. This isn't the first time it's come up. Our nation is now 250 years old. So these legal issues have come up, and I'm curious to know what the law is regarding this. It's been litigated, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But like how much constitution do you get, basically?
I think we should start, like, what we should do, the best way to learn it is to try to get through the citizenship process. So we should do Project Citizenship Carolina.
As you're talking, I'm like, oh, I want to help her.
Let's do Project Citizenship Carolina. We'll get a GoFundMe account. We'll get the best lawyers out there.
No, remember, you can't buy it. It's a whole process.
No, but the lawyers can advocate for it. So that's what the GoFundMe would pay for.
Okay, so they can find a way to get me the citizenship.
Yes, they can understand what the laws are and navigate you through that legal labyrinth to get you approved as a citizenship. And as we navigate it, then we can understand, okay, this is a legitimate question. This is total bureaucratic crap.
Yeah.
And cut through it.
And it's all transactional. I mean, that's the type of law we practice. So whether it's bankruptcy, or we don't practice bankruptcy, but we've done that in the past, and it's very transactional. So it's using federal code. So immigration is very similar to that.
But
there's no money in it. But
yeah. But here's my caveat. One thing we practice, which we hate, is Medicaid applications. Mm-hmm. Because I know what the actual requirements are, and I know when somebody qualifies, but I also have to go through that application process with the government, and we will get denied almost every time.
Really?
I expect a denial on the first one. And I actually use the denial to create the strategy for the next application. I don't waste a whole lot of time with the first application because I don't know what they're going to hone in on for the first denial. And once I receive that first denial, fortunately, they have to put it out in writing what grounds the denial is on. And so then once I can satisfy those requirements, then we can get the applicant approved. But it takes a long time, and it takes a ton of energy that for me, it's hard to bill my client for because we charge flat fees. And so I only do it to keep involved in the process so our estate plans can enable people to more easily go through and apply if they qualify for Medicaid. But the component, you know, Adam's talking about, this is transactional. Yes, it is to a point, but then the government ultimately makes a decision. And when they decide no for the wrong reason, it's this bureaucrat that's got no accountability to us that we've got to push through.
So we'll make you a deal. We'll help you do that if you help us get land in Mexico. Because only
land in Mexico. You'll put it under my name.
Fideicomiso.
Okay.
For generations to come.
Okay, deal.
Nice. Project Citizenship Carolina.
There you go. Well, any other words of wisdom for us before we go? We're out of time. Yeah.
Well, I don't think so. I think the conversation was very productive. I think you learned about me things I haven't told you in the past. So
if once we get you your citizenship card, what are we going to do to celebrate?
Celebrate?
Yeah.
We're going to Mexico.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Hermosillo.
Yes.
DFA.
Hermosillo. The beach is like 40 minutes away from Hermosillo.
Really?
Okay.
Hermosillo is over by, so it's that way. It's over south of Tijuana then.
South. It's south. Yes.
Okay. Hermosillo or bust.
Okay.
I love it. Okay. That's a big commitment, getting her citizenship.
We're going to do it.
I don't know if I'm going to commit to that.
Thank you, Catalina. 10 years.
It'll take, yeah.
Thank you for having me. I had fun.
Thanks for coming in again.